If you're listening to this podcast, there's a really high chance that you are also interested in cookbooks. So I wanted to let you guys know that my cookbook, Elevated Everyday Paleo, is officially out wherever you get your books from. It's a collection of recipes that I believe make everyday cooking just a bit more special, and I hope it reminds you that there's art in so many little moments of life. You can grab it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local bookseller. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Manual Mode. I'm your host, Mariah Sautel, and today on the podcast, I'm talking to Sara Silm, a freelance journalist and stylist who currently resides in southwestern France. It's hard to sum up Sara in a paragraph because she does and is so much and has lived many lives on just about every continent throughout her multifaceted career. These days, you might know her from her dreamy Instagram account, Chateau Montfort, where you can escape into her stunningly styled images of the French countryside. Her book, How to French Country, gives a glimpse into her styling process and how she creates what can only be described as je ne sais quoi. I don't know if we can even scratch the surface of Sara's creative genius in a podcast interview, but I'm determined to at least try. So welcome to the podcast, Sara. I've been an admirer of your work for quite some time, and I can't wait to hear your story. So I feel like with everything you've done, the only logical place for us to start is the beginning. So can you take me back to your first home in Australia and tell me just about that and how you first connected with art and creativity?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Manly in Sydney, which is it's a suburb just on the north side of the Sydney Harbour. It was just a very idyllic Australian childhood spent mostly in the sand, on the beaches, and then I went to university. I studied. I did a Bachelor of Arts majoring in literature and history. And then I left Australia, went to the Middle East and then to South Africa and then came back. And it was at that stage I met my gorgeous husband and we decided to leave Sydney and move to an area called the Southern Highlands. So it's about an hour and a half south of Sydney. And it's as close to the English countryside as I think you'll get in Australia. So it's really lovely, kind of inland from the coast in lush green rolling hills. And we bought our first house there. And it's an interesting story, actually, because when I was living in the Middle East, I bizarrely just happened to be working for the Crown Prince of Bahrain, who's now the king of Bahrain, and I accepted no gifts from him, but I did fall ill one night and had to go home from quite an elaborate party, which just happened to be in Cannes in the south of France. It was a really bizarre other life I used to lead, and he sent me as a get well present this incredible Ebel Swiss solid gold watch, which I just don't have the lifestyle for. I actually don't wear jewelry. I'm not really into anything like that. And so this watch stayed in its box until we went on our honeymoon and we sold it in London and came home with enough money to place a deposit on our first house. So we bought this house and I remember we were so poor. When we were doing work on the house, we would run down the road to get a hamburger and chips and for our lunch, and we'd literally empty our pockets to pay for the simplest things. It was just all hands-on hard labor on our part, and it was a lovely kind of Victorian well, first by Australian standards, it was quite an old house. And we renovated it bit by bit, and it really became just a gorgeous home. And I, you know, have really fond memories of that house. So that was our first house, and it all kind of began from there.
What about kind of the writing and photography side of your work? When did you first kind of stumble into that?
Well, it would have been around about that time. I've always written just for pleasure, and I just can't help but write. It's just something I love doing. And I remember pitching a story to an editor at a country, it's in a magazine in Australia called Country Style. And at that time, it was a bit different, the print media industry, because advertising was still coming, you know, we hadn't had the crash. It was actually a great time to start a career in freelance journalism and styling, photography, anything like that, because they had the money to pay for freelancers. After the crash, that all stopped virtually. I mean, I'm sure it still happens, but it became a lot harder because they tended to take everything in-house. But at that time, it was a terrific time to really back yourself and just pitch stories to editors. I'd go and do recce shots of just lovely homes that I knew of, or ask friends if they knew of any, and then pitch stories to editors. And then what tends to happen, and when you're starting out from scratch with no byline, no, you know, you're a nobody, is that you just need that first story, or the first few, and then you get a bit of a momentum. And as long as you're taking an editor, or, well, back then, as long as you were taking editors' quality features, it was a given, and you know, you gradually you're able to build your byline and build your name. So that's how I started.
Do you remember what your first story was that you got published?
I don't actually. Gosh, because it was a long time ago. But I do remember. I mean, I do have an amazing collection of, you know, tear pages from all of these stories. But yeah, I think it was just a lovely home, probably in the Southern Highlands. I did do homes in Sydney as well. And then I would, as things grew and progressed, I'd travel further afield. But it's just, I think, a good, there's a difference between a good home in terms of a nice spread in terms of the photo shoot. But I also found that when I was freelancing these stories, it was a great opportunity to give a complete package with the copy as well, because I'd spend the day styling the house and talking to the owners. And so by the end of the day, at least in my head, I'd virtually written the story. I knew, you know, how to structure it and what the actual story was. But I think it always makes a difference when it's a home that's authentically done and that has a story, a backstory, because a lot of homes, beautiful homes that present really well on the page, you know, they might have been done by interior designers, and actually there's not a lot of story. So although they're aesthetically, you know, nice to look at, they're not so much of an interesting read. So I loved the fact that I was able to do both and tell the story as well as present the images.
Did all of your traveling and living in so many different places, has that kind of given you an even more perspective, especially when you're trying to seek out these stories from the people whose homes you're photographing? Like, I just feel like you've seen so many different ways to live that must kind of inform your storytelling in a way. Can you speak a little to that?
Yeah, I think one thing that's come out of living in so many different cultures, at the end of the day, is that you know, I remember when I moved to Russia, I couldn't speak the language, and my husband would go off to work. He was in finance and banking, which is all conducted in English, or was at that time. And so I had to really, I was dealing with everybody from, you know, shop assistants to people who came to fix something in the apartment or something like that. So I had to learn the language immediately. And I think when language is a barrier, and I've had this in many countries I've lived in, you actually experience things in a completely different way, because suddenly you're not on autopilot and you engage all your senses. So you smell more, you listen more, you don't talk nearly as much as you would in your own environment. And I think it opens your eyes to endless possibilities. And I think we forget in our day-to-day lives, in our comfortable environments, that so much of what's around us is never seen or tasted or felt or smelt. And just because it's easy to take the shortest route. So I think that has definitely informed the way I see things creatively and approach the world now.
Yeah, for sure. So speaking a little more about writing, I know it's something that a lot of people want to do but struggle with. I think it's one of the hardest things sometimes to be able to do. I think it was like, I heard Jerry Seinfeld say that, like, it's the hardest thing and no one can actually do it. But clearly you can do it. So I'm curious if you have any advice for someone who wants to get better at writing, either just for themselves or for their career.
I think Nike say it best, just do it. It's literally the same as if you want to get fit, you can go and buy the, you know, $150 shoes. But if they sit in your cupboard at home, you're never going to get fit. And it's the same with writing. I think it could be journaling. It could be, you know, if you're on social media, I think a great opportunity these days is just to do a long form caption. And if you post every day, then speak to the picture. Okay, you know, maybe half the people who see that picture, it's a visual platform, but maybe half the people might read the caption. But don't write the caption expecting it to get likes. Write it and tell a story and make it your own and make it your daily form of writing. In fact, long-form captions on social media are a great discipline, because it does force you to really structure a small story in a limited amount of words. So it really is that. And it's the same with photography. You know, I think people expect that they have to spend a lot of money on cameras and lenses. And in fact, it's not the case. I think you'll be a better photographer if you just work with what you've got and take it from there. Because these, you know, expensive DSLR cameras could probably do, people probably use 5-10% of what they're capable of at the end of the day. So I think, I think it's really just do it. You just have to take the discipline to make it a part of your daily practice and find fun ways of building it in. And the more you do it, the more natural it becomes. And I also think, obviously, reading is brilliant for vocab and just experiencing other styles of writing. So I used to read physical books all the time, but these days I just find audiobooks are a great way of incorporating literature and dialogue into your day. So it's all part of it, one way or the other, kind of coming in or going out on the page. Words, no matter how you absorb them or release them, get as many in your day as you can.
Are there any practices that you have around your writing time or just creativity in general? I know, you know, some people find that walking to a certain place is helpful. Are there any things that kind of really help you get into the mood to write?
I find writing, I guess people think of writing as putting words on the page, typing them, writing them physically. But actually, I personally find that probably, I would say 80% of my writing occurs away from the keyboard. I write when I'm doing things, and I have a daily kind of morning walk where I just find my words come to me then. And if I'm really struggling, and you're right with Jerry Seinfeld, his quote, it's true. Sometimes it can be the most excruciating process, and you just sit and nothing comes. And it's at that point that I would say, you know, go for the walk, do the exercise, do some house cleaning, cook, just switch off your brain, and it's just a release. Things will come to you. And I think we have to think about writing not as so much as the physical process of actually typing, but actually allowing our brains to just be creative and be free. And then I think the whole thing comes together. So it's a bit like planning a holiday. You know, when you sit down, you've got the dates on your laptop and you start planning a trip. To me, that's when the travel begins, because in your mind's eye, you're imagining it. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, the moment travel commences. So I think we need to think about writing the same way.
I love that. So I couldn't have a conversation with you without talking about your chateau, of course. So can you tell me a little bit about the story of how that came to be, and then what the process has been of just kind of growing that into both a home and then also kind of this business as well?
Yeah. Well, we were living in Kazakhstan at the time, in Almaty, which is at the base of one of the most magnificent mountain ranges. It was on the old Silk Road. So we were living there, and our children were in boarding school in the UK at the time, because prior to that we were in Russia, and things, you know, became quite difficult in Russia before we left, because there was a war with Ukraine, and so we felt that they were better off in school in the UK. So I was kind of splitting my time between, we rented a cottage near the school so I could spend as much time with them as possible, but also we had an apartment in Almaty, and we just wanted a home, albeit at that stage it was a holiday home, to bring them home to and to start to make memories as a family rather than in rented cottages, apartments and hotels. So we were actually at dinner with a friend of ours, an English friend of ours, in Almaty one night, and he suggested that we look in the region of France where he had bought a house 15 years prior. And we love skiing, we love beaches, we love hiking, and he suggested this region. So we thought, well, why not? We just popped down there and had a real, really quick whirlwind tour. So that's how it came to be. We found this empty house. It had been empty for more than 20 years. And it's a really, as glamorous as the word chateau is, it's really not a chateau in the sense that it's more of what the French call a maison de maître. It's like a master's house, someone who would have made their living off the land and the rents off their land and small holdings and things like that. But it was, they did about 10 years after it was built, extend it with a couple of towers. So, and it's a very modest village where we live, you know, 180 inhabitants. So it's relative to the size of its village. It is a chateau. It is called the chateau, but it's all relevant. It's certainly not Walt Disney. But what I loved about it was the fact that it wasn't very boastful and proud. It's a homely home, and it has a stream behind it, a little orchard, a lovely walled garden, and it was just totally charming and beguiling from the minute we stepped in the door. So from that point onwards, it took a year just to make it livable. So it was really me coming down 2 weeks at a time and camping inside. We had to strip the electrics, the plumbing, the heating, everything, and start from scratch in terms of those things that needed to be certified to today's standards. And then it's been ongoing. And, well, nearly 6 years later, I'm still doing things. So it's ongoing.
Now, I know you have also started offering ways for people to come stay here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in my book, I wanted to actually give people an example, and I don't think this is done very often at all, but I wanted to give someone, the reader, a chance to see in real time what it would be like to renovate a typical kind of house. So we took our barn, which was a barn. It literally had corn in the roof and rats in the roof and a dirt floor, and there was nothing in it, just some wood and a broken down old ride-on mower. And we turned that into a two-bedroom cottage with a bathroom, kitchen, lounge room. So essentially it was like a mini version of anyone's house. It has everything in it that you would ever renovate in the course of a general house refurb. So I shot that in real time in the book, and it has its own chapter. And I documented it in photos and writing, and it became a great little vignette, so to speak, in the practicalities of renovating, but particularly in the style of this, you know, French country style. So when that was finished, we do use it ourselves as a family. It's a great place to go now just to have some time out, read, light the fire, and relax. And sometimes when we entertain, it's a great space to have larger groups when we're entertaining. But for the majority of the time, it's not used. So we decided to, just for a limited period of time each year, that we'll open it up to bookings. So it's just a two-bedroom cottage with a little walled garden in the middle of the countryside. So it's very rustic and rural. It's not our region is totally authentic and rural, and not at all developed like Provence is now, with the flashy restaurants and the expensive menu du jour and the fancy shops. It's really the kind of place that you'd want to come to if you wanted to imagine what France was like when Peter Mayol wrote A Year in Provence, you know, 20 odd years ago. So it's very authentic, but a lovely place to come if you love hiking, if you love the river. There's a beautiful river that runs past our village, and market shopping and all those things, but really, really rural.
That sounds amazing. Can you tell me a little bit more about your book and how the process came of starting to write that?
Yeah, I was commissioned by Thames and Hudson to write it. They approached me and asked me to write what essentially at the time was a slightly different book to what it became. But because I started to write it before COVID, before the pandemic, during the course of the pandemic, as we all know, having stared at four walls for as long as we all have, I think now that things are starting to change, we've certainly learned some lessons and life has become more home focused. So we are probably going to continue to work from home, and people are suddenly more home focused and spending more time on our environment. So we decided to refocus it somewhat to become more of a hands-on manual to achieving a certain decor aesthetic, in this case being French country. So I used to teach colour and design in Sydney at the International School of Colour and Design, and I know how hard it is for the average person who's not professionally trained to, I think the real question for most people is, where do I start? It's really tricky. And I remember when I had interior design clients, colour was always a massive stumbling block. People, I don't know why, but people are terrified of it. And you know, it's not nearly as scary if you if you're able to get, you know, what was really nice with this book was that because I was dealing with a specific aesthetic, being French country, I could keep the colors foolproof. So tonally and chromatically, they're quite similar. So it's a no fail combination of colors. You could take any of them and put all of them in one room, or a couple, or one, or whatever, and they all, it's like a happy family, they all work together. So there's nothing terrifying about the color palettes that are in the book. I've taken commercial colors, I've taken colors from my local landscape, whether it be old patina colors off a door or a shutter in my village or another village, or from the landscape, and I've actually used an international paint color code system called NCS color, which is generally it's what designers would use. You can actually take one of these codes and turn it into a tile, or have leather dyed in that color, or you could take it to a kitchen company, for example, but you can also take it to a paint company and that mixes paints. And you can look on their website, there's a list of international suppliers, and you can take these codes and essentially bring a piece of France back to your house and paint your front door, or your powder room, or whatever it may be. So I really enjoyed being able to make colour much less terrifying and give readers, you know, I always find when people come to France, they walk through villages and think, oh, that shutter, the colors are so beautiful. And the fact is that all these old villages, the paint that you're seeing is not the paint that went on 50 years ago. It's the paint that's become patinaed, and it might be because it's on the south side of the house and it's just got that lovely weathered look. So it's just a joy to be able to literally put that colour in a tin for someone and let them enjoy it and love it on the other side of the world.
I love that. Can you give any tips for anyone who's wanting to tap a little more into their own sense of design and style?
Yes, I think really that's the core of what this book's all about, because I think we, particularly now with social media, I think whether it be from a physical point of view or fashion point of view, or in terms of your home, there is a massive curated presence on social media that puts enormous pressure on individuals to kind of work out who they are, what they feel they need to be, or what they actually really are. So I think it's really important to kind of strip things right back to basics and start to identify what it is that you want to feel when you go into a room. Think less about what you want it to look like. I think that's the key. We're so focused on these images that we're confronted with every day of these, what we consider to be perfect interiors. But what you have to do when you see these images is think of what you're feeling when you see that image, because that's essentially, that's the magic and the smoke and mirrors and all stuff that we as designers create. And, you know, if I was doing a commercial brief, it's great with commercial businesses because it is smoke and mirrors. You're creating the feeling that that particular commercial business wants their customers to feel. But in the home, it's already in you. You are that feeling. It's just a matter of taking it in a step-by-step process, finding what it is that makes you feel good, and then breaking it down into color and texture and the things that you want around you. And you might actually find that because homes are so sentimental, a lot of those things that have meaning for you as an individual are already there, and it's just a matter of incorporating them into a total aesthetic.
Can you tell everyone where your book is available?
So it's been physically launched in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia and New Zealand now. So it's available in all independent bookstores and, you know, Targets and Amazon and Booktopia and all your online sources. So that's all happening now. But in the Northern Hemisphere, it's being launched in the USA, in the UK, and in Europe in March. So you can place online orders on Amazon now, and it will become available in March. But then, of course, once it's rolled out, it will again be available in independent bookstores and everywhere you buy your books normally.
Wonderful. So I have one last question for you, but I want to read something that I found that you wrote. So I didn't warn you about this, so don't be afraid. It's because it's very lovely that I wanted to read it. So you had this on your website. You said, one of the greatest things about being different is being able to look through life's cracks to find the extraordinary and the ordinary and survive more on instinct than experience. It also brings with it infinite opportunities to laugh at yourself, something I find myself doing more than a few times every day. And I love this because I find it to be very true for myself and my own creative journey. And I love the note about laughing at yourself because I feel like that's an essential skill when you want to work as a creative entrepreneur in particular. So can you tell me about a mistake that you've made and what you learned from it that you can now just kind of laugh at and also know that you grew from?
Oh gosh, I think I make a complete fool of myself dozens of times every day, mainly due to language, I must say, because I've lived outside of my native English speaking zone for many, many, many years. So language gives me infinite opportunities to make a complete deal of myself. So that happens every day. I don't think, no matter how much I improve in speaking French, I can ever, ever claim to speak it perfectly. And so that is just a constant. I think the older you get, the more comfortable you are with making mistakes. It doesn't worry me anymore. My children are always very embarrassed about the things that I say, but I don't care anymore. And I just laugh it off. And it's great because you do grow from that. I can't think of a single example because I'm constantly making a fool of myself. It's just one giant joke, really. I can't think of one on the spot, but yes, it's constant. And it is incredibly humbling because, you know, you have to make mistakes in order to improve. And I think it comes down to anything creative. Anyone creative will tell you that without the mistakes, you'd never find the opportunities. So keep making mistakes. And if you can learn another language, do it, because it is the most humbling thing you will ever do in your life, because, you just feel like a complete idiot most of the day.
I feel laughing at yourself is just a survival skill, I think, in this creative endeavor. But I love that. I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much, Sarah. I'm sorry.
But you know what happens? All Sarah's answer to Sarah. So we don't make it easy for anyone. It's a pleasure. It really is. It's been so lovely to chat with you today, Moira. And thank you so much for including me. And I hope that if anyone's out there listening, that it brings them a bit of inspiration, perhaps.
Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in to another episode of Manual Mode. I hope you found this helpful and inspiring. I know I did. You can find links to everything about our guest in the show notes, and I will be back again next week with another interview for you. In the meantime, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. And until next time, keep creating. Thank you.